10-year-old Bianca LeBron stood outside of her school in Bridgeport, Connecticut, but she wasn't planning on attending class. Instead, she told friends and her teacher that her uncle would be picking her up for a day of shopping and fun. Moments later, an unknown man pulled up in a brown van and drove away with Bianca. No one thought much of it until they learned that Bianca LeBron didn't have an uncle. For years, police have tried to track down the driver of the van. They thought they'd solved the case just over a year later when they located a person of interest, but they simply didn't have the evidence to make a solid connection. And while some believe they had the right man, others have argued that the true abductor remains unknown. How does a 10-year-old walk away from her school, get into a van, and vanish without anyone even questioning it? That question would become the source for a massive civil suit launched against the city. And while that case has since been settled, the truth of what became of Bianca remains unknown. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 131, The Disappearance of Bianca LeBron. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the details surrounding the horrifying disappearance of 10-year-old Bianca LeBron. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. The show is also available on MeWe and Minds. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon available at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions directly through the website or email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. A 10-year-old girl walks across the front lawn of her school, climbs into a van with an unidentified man in broad daylight with witnesses watching, and she never comes home. This is episode 131, The Disappearance of Bianca LeBron. It was a chilly fall morning when 10-year-old Bianca LeBron arrived to the familiar brick building, Elias House School, where she attended fifth grade. Bianca loved school and enjoyed getting to spend time in the company of her friends. She never sought out an excuse to get away for a day, whether that be faking sick to catch a break or just explaining that she didn't want to go. Like many children her age, school was still fun and exciting, and she eagerly anticipated each day. However, on the morning of Wednesday, November 7th, 2001, she had another reason to be excited, and it had nothing to do with academics or her friends. On this particular day, Bianca announced she wouldn't be attending classes and instead would be getting picked up to go shopping. Regardless of their love for school, most children aren't going to turn down the opportunity to have a fun day picking up clothes or toys, and Bianca was no different. According to witness statements, Bianca explained to her teacher that her uncle was going to be picking her up for that day. When Bianca told her friends, she explained they were heading off to the mall to do some shopping. Being the sweet, kind young girl that she is, Bianca even extended an invitation to her circle of friends. If any of them wanted to go along, it wouldn't be a problem as her uncle would be there soon and they could join her on her mall adventure. None of Bianca's friends accepted that invitation, thankfully, and Bianca's teacher didn't question the veracity of her claim. There was no request for a signed note from a parent, no call home to verify anything. In fact, there was nothing done to confirm the story at all. At approximately 8:30 a.m., as children were filing into the school for the beginning of classes, an older model, two-tone brown van pulled up in front of the school. Bianca turned, heading away from the building and her classmates. The door popped open and Bianca climbed inside the vehicle, driven by a man who several witnesses got a good look at, enough to describe him as being an older Hispanic male, believed to be between the ages of 20 and 30, with dark hair and a beard. No one questioned the man, no one questioned Bianca. As far as everyone present was concerned, the man picking her up that day was her uncle. As classes began, Bianca's teacher simply made a notation on the attendance report, marking the 10-year-old as absent as the vehicle pulled away from the curb. There was, of course, one major problem. Bianca LeBron didn't have an uncle, and as far as her family knew, she was in school that morning. Bianca Elaine LeBron was born on June 26, 1991, to parents Carmelita Torres and Wilberto LeBron. By 2001, Bianca was living in Bridgeport, Connecticut with her mother and stepfather, Angelo Garcia. Although Carmelita and Wilberto had divorced years prior, it's been said that they maintained a friendly relationship and there were no issues between them, especially when it came to Bianca. Bianca has a younger sister named Janissa, with whom she was very close, as well as a brother and an older sister. According to the Charlie Project, Bianca has been described as having a very outgoing personality and high self-esteem. She made friends easily, loved to talk and laugh, and wasn't necessarily hesitant to talk with new people. Bianca had numerous hobbies to keep herself entertained, though most frequently mentioned is her love for dancing and singing, which she would reportedly do whenever she had the opportunity. Beyond that, she loved to shop and often visited one of two malls, Milford or Trumbull, the latter of which was located closer to her home. Bianca had a pet hamster named Nina, who she spent a lot of time playing with, and her favorite color was noted as being purple. In 2001, school records indicate that she was a bright student who rarely missed any days and was considered by teachers to be a well-behaved, enthusiastic young student with a high aptitude. Her mother later told reporters that her daughter loved school and always focused on finishing her homework before she would go outside to play. One neighbor, Amy Cologne, told the New York Times, quote, "She was a very beautiful little girl and always happy riding her bike or playing tag," end quote. No one knew that Bianca had disappeared that morning. As far as her family was concerned, she would follow her usual routine of attending classes and then heading to one of a handful of locations, either the home of a relative or to one of her friends' houses. Police later told the New York Times that some of the confusion surrounding her disappearance may have been related to the fluid nature of her schedule, which often saw her going to one of several different locations before going home. In fact, no one in Bianca's family even noted her as being missing until approximately 4:30 p.m., 8 hours after she had been last seen by classmates. Initially, there wasn't a tremendous amount of concern. Months previous, in January, Bianca had gone missing for several hours until it was discovered that she'd gone to a friend's home and lost track of time. Maybe that's why no one made any calls or became genuinely concerned until the day began turning into night. In hopes of locating Bianca, Carmelita made multiple calls to friends and relatives, though none of them had seen her that day. At approximately 8:30 p.m., 12 hours after Bianca had last been seen, her sister informed their mother that she hadn't seen Bianca in school that day, and normally she would. After further calls and searches for Bianca, her mother finally picked up the phone and called the Bridgeport police to report her daughter missing at approximately 10:24 p.m. At the time, it's important to note, Bianca's family had not been contacted about her absence from school, nor had they been told of this story of a supposed uncle picking her up to take her shopping. When police arrived at the family's Clinton Avenue home, Carmelita gave a breakdown of the morning and the last time she saw her daughter. According to her statement, it was approximately 8 a.m., and Bianca was waiting for her older sister and four cousins, with whom she walked to and from school each day. Carmelita later told Maury Povich that her last words to her daughter were that she would see her later that day. She later explained to the Connecticut Post, quote, "I just keep asking myself why. Why my daughter? Why my family? But so far, I don't have any answers. It's something I can never forget. I live with it every day," end quote. While police took down the missing persons report, they made several notes. Most prominently, that as far as her family knew, she had attended school that day, and it was highly unlike her to skip out on a day, let alone without them being notified beforehand. Of course, when authorities went down to Elias Howe School to find out what had gone on that day, they discovered the truth, and ultimately, a series of breakdowns in the school's policy guidelines, which would later become the subject of a civil suit filed by Bianca's family. Reportedly, school procedure in place at the time required Bianca's teacher to get verification of her absence. When Bianca explained that her uncle was picking her up to go shopping, someone from the school's administration was supposed to contact one of Bianca's parents. This policy stood in place anytime someone other than the child's legal guardian would attempt to remove them from school grounds. But obviously, that didn't happen here. When school superintendent Sonia Salcido was asked about the massive lapse in protocol, she told the Hartford Courant, quote, "We are devastated by it. We are horrified that this thing happened under our watch," end quote. At the time, Bianca's teacher was suspended pending a school board investigation to determine why exactly those protocols had not been followed. Police now had a troubling situation on their hands. Instead of Bianca having been missing for a few hours following the end of school, they learned she had been missing for over 12 hours, and they had almost nothing to go on. Speaking with several of Bianca's friends, they were given the story about her uncle, but when investigators questioned Bianca's family about his identity, they quickly discovered that Bianca may have been using the term uncle more casually, as in someone who was a family friend or someone who was simply older than her, rather than it actually being a legal relative. While police didn't have much information in terms of who the man was that picked up Bianca that day, they did get both a good description of his appearance and the vehicle he was driving. The man was described as being Hispanic, between the ages of 20 and 30. Height was estimated to have been between 5 feet 8 inches and 5 feet 11 inches tall, and while no weight estimate is given, he's been said to have had a medium build. Witnesses stated that the driver had black curly hair, styled in a semi-afro with long sideburns and a beard. His eyes were noted as being brown, and multiple witnesses described a prominent nose as well as there appearing to be scratches on his cheeks. The man was dressed in a long-sleeved blue pullover shirt with the brand Gap printed on both the front and along the right sleeve. He also wore FUBU brand jeans with an image depicting the cartoon character Fat Albert on the right rear pocket, as well as scuffed brown Timberland brand boots. According to authorities, witnesses stated that the man made no attempt to conceal his face or identity during the time he was picking up Bianca. Considering that multiple witnesses had gotten a good look at the man, police were able to complete a composite sketch, which has been widely distributed. In terms of the van, it's been described as being a brown, two-tone, or possibly beige van in poor condition, with several sanded areas on the exterior. Reportedly, the van had several areas showing body damage, as well as tinted windows and chrome trim on the sides. After speaking with witnesses and members of the school administration, police returned to Bianca's family explaining the circumstances regarding this so-called uncle. Police were informed that Bianca didn't have an uncle, and no one in the family seemed to know anyone who owned a van which fit that description. At the time, police explained to the media that they were investigating this as a likely non-familial abduction and were seeking both the van and the man seen driving it, who they believed was the abductor and would have information regarding Bianca's whereabouts. However, it was noted in discussion with the Hartford Courant that it's extremely rare for children to be abducted from school, especially at the beginning of the day. Typically in those cases, those abductions are connected to custody disputes. But in this case, there was no dispute between Carmelita and Wilberto, and both would dedicate their time to searching for Bianca and putting up flyers all over town. Sergeant Jesus Ortiz of the Bridgeport Police Department's Youth Bureau was initially put in charge of the investigation, though he had a limited amount of information to work with. Despite the prevalence of flyers and media attention given to Bianca's case, the vast majority of calls and tips investigators received failed to turn up any new information or send them in the right direction. Ortiz later told the Hartford Courant, quote, "We have leads to work on, but usually they turn out to be rumors. But we check everything. Everything." End quote. Unfortunately, there were very few developments early on, and for several months, authorities continued telling the media that they were actively working the investigation, but had no new updates to deliver. In December, a month after Bianca's disappearance, police received a tip via telephone from someone who believed they had spotted Bianca in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In response, they sent notifications to local police departments, but there was no further developments. It appeared that while the sighting was initially believed to have been legitimate, It was later ruled out as the sighting could not be confirmed to have actually been Bianca, and there were no subsequent sightings of the child matching her description. For investigators, it was back to square one. For Bianca's family, it was a nightmare. Carmelita struggled to sleep and spent most of her free time putting up flyers of Bianca on street signs, lampposts, and in storefronts. She also was engaged in a very contentious battle with the school board, arguing that her daughter had been abducted on their watch and it was their fault that she had gone missing in the first place. Carmelita would ultimately file a civil suit against the city. However, in order to pursue that lawsuit of wrongful death, she would have to have her daughter declared legally dead. While Carmelita argued that she fully believed Bianca was alive out there, she did, in April of 2002, 5 months after the abduction, convince a probate judge to have her daughter declared dead, according to the New York Times. For many, this was seen as bizarre considering how little time had passed. In many cases, years pass before a family seeks to have a missing person legally declared deceased. Sergeant Ortiz later replied to this, telling the Times that the decision was, quote, strange, but not suspicious, end quote. Around this same time, investigators announced that they had a person of interest they were seeking as being possibly linked to Bianca's abduction. The person of interest was identified as 20-year-old Jason Lara, a man who Bianca had apparently spent a lot of time with in the months prior to her abduction. In what I can only describe as incredibly bizarre and disturbing, Lara was reported in multiple sources as being Bianca's, quote, secret boyfriend, end quote. Now, I don't mean to get mired in the semantics here, but I think it's pretty damn important to note that a 10-year-old cannot have a secret boyfriend when that boyfriend is 20 years old. The details get more disturbing, as multiple friends of Bianca's apparently told authorities that Bianca had, several times in the past, told them that she had a crush on an older man named Jason, and according to multiple news reports, several people later confirmed that they had caught the two kissing. A 20-year-old and a 10-year-old. If that sentence doesn't piss you off as much as it pisses me off, I'm not sure what to say to you. Reportedly, Bianca's great uncle was, at the time, involved in a relationship with Lara's mother, which is how Bianca came to know him. It's also important to note that Lara had a friend who owned a van which closely matched the description given as the one Bianca was seen getting into. Bianca's grandmother, Sonia, later told the New Haven Register, quote, Bianca knew him. She often went to his house, but I don't think she was dating him. She's a little too baby to be dating, end quote. According to the same article, Sonia noted that Lara's name had come up in conversation with other family members as possibly being connected to Bianca's disappearance. While investigators had a name, they had one major problem. They didn't know where Lara was. He apparently left Bridgeport within a month of Bianca's disappearance. It came to the attention of investigators that Lara had previously been fingerprinted but signed his name as Jason Gonzalez, which qualifies as forgery since he never legally changed his name. Lara had previously been arrested and charged in 1998 with attempted carjacking and was sentenced to serve 7 years in prison, though he was released early and was out during the time that Bianca was abducted. In hopes of being able to track him down, a warrant was issued for his arrest for second-degree forgery. Reportedly, after seeing an article written about the case in which his name was mentioned, Lara picked up the phone and called the Bridgeport police in April of 2003. He didn't disclose his location, but he did deny that he had played any role in Bianca's disappearance. Police were able to trace his call to Fort Myers, Florida. Florida authorities later came upon Lara and became aware of the warrant for his arrest. Lara was taken into custody in November, 2 years after Bianca had disappeared. He was unable to meet his $100,000 bail and waived extradition, being sent back to Connecticut, at which time he would be questioned by investigators. For them, it was a major break in the case. Not only did they have multiple witnesses describing a close, albeit disturbing and inappropriate relationship between Lara and Bianca, but he also closely matched the artist's composite which had been drawn up. Sheila Santiago, a spokesperson for the Bridgeport Police Department, when asked about the arrest, told the Record Journal, quote, "He's in custody, and we believe he has vital information to the case," end quote. Asked about Lauer's cooperation, it was noted that police were working to get information out of him, and while he wasn't necessarily being uncooperative, he wasn't making things easy either. At the time of his arrest, Lauer was living with his fiancée, Corey Vitti, and their 5-year-old son. Vitti, for her part, was adamant that nothing inappropriate had gone on between Lauer and Bianca, telling the Fort Myers News Press, quote, "I was with him the last time he saw her. The allegations are absolutely ridiculous," end quote. According to Vitti, she had seen Bianca in Jason's company on several occasions, but she alleged Lauer had not seen the 10-year-old since the summer of 2001, some 4 or 5 months prior to her abduction. Unfortunately, despite all of the information they had, authorities didn't have enough to officially charge Lauer. In fact, after multiple sessions of questioning, Lauer was able to walk free. When asked about this later, police explained that he had been able to supply them with an alibi for his whereabouts during the time that Bianca was abducted, and the alibi checked out. The details of that alibi have never been revealed, though for many, it seems highly unlikely that someone else was involved. Lauer, though, maintained his innocence, telling reporters outside of the courthouse, quote, "I don't have anything to do with her disappearance. I don't know where she is," end quote. While it seemed police had found a man who fit what they were looking for, they had no choice but to let him walk free. Lauer would later face arrest in 2011, stemming from unrelated burglary charges. After that arrest, police once again approached him to discuss Bianca, but he refused to comment further on the case, and police had no ability to force him into having that conversation. Following Lara's release from custody, there have been very few updates regarding Bianca's case. In March of 2008, 6.5 years after her disappearance, a settlement agreement was finally met between Bianca's family and the city of Bridgeport. Ultimately, $750,000 was offered in response to the wrongful death suit. According to the Record Journal, the family would be subject to 6 annual payments of $125,000. While the city acknowledged their terrible mistakes that had been made and noted that they hoped the settlement would offer some closure to the family, Angelo Marcos, the family's attorney, didn't feel this was sufficient, telling the Record Journal, quote, "This doesn't make the family happy. What would make them happy is if the police would continue their investigation and find out what happened to Bianca," end quote. A year later, in August of 2009, state police converged on Seaside Park, located just over a mile south of Elias House School. According to the Greenwich Times newspaper, police explained that while questioning a suspect on an unrelated case, they were given information that a young female might be buried in the park. While they couldn't be certain, police stated it was possible that child could be Bianca LeBron. Captain James Valladero told the Times, quote, "We had some information on a prior crime and did some digging as part of an evidence recovery," end quote. Through the use of 2 backhoes, an area of 50 by 20 feet was dug up along the shoreline. In total, the dig lasted approximately 2 hours and no human remains were recovered. When Detective John Burke took over Bianca's case, he inherited more than 50 cardboard filing boxes filled with reports, tips, and information on the case. Burke took Bianca's case very seriously and began working to try and run down leads and find answers. While the cynic in him thinks it's unlikely Bianca will be found alive, he admits there's that chance, telling the Connecticut Post, quote, "She's got to be somewhere, either dead or alive. I want to believe she's alive, but that's because I'm a positive thinker. But statistically, it's against her being alive. But I want to hope that she is," end quote. According to Burke, the case is still very much open and they occasionally receive tips, though none of them have ever panned out. He noted in his interview that one tip had led them to New Mexico. A user through a chat room had claimed to have seen a photo of a girl who resembled Bianca, but upon investigation, it was ruled to have been a case of mistaken identity. For the most part, outside of Jason Lauer, there have been no developments in Bianca's case. Bianca Elaine LeBron has been missing since November 7th, 2001. At the time of her disappearance, Bianca was described as being a Hispanic female with brown hair and hazel eyes, standing 4 feet 11 inches tall and weighing approximately 115 pounds. Bianca has a birthmark on her forehead and was last seen wearing a green, beige, and camouflage shirt, beige pants, black boots, and a dark blue denim jacket. She was picked up in a two-tone brown van with chrome trim, tinted windows, and obvious body damage outside of Elias Howe School in Bridgeport, Connecticut. If alive today, Bianca would be 29 years old. Age-progressed photographs have been made available in her case, and a composite sketch remains available of the man who is believed to have abducted her. It's been nearly 19 years since 10-year-old Bianca LeBron was abducted from outside of her school. Despite the considerations given to Jason Lara, no other persons of interest or potential suspects have ever been named. While much of Bianca's family has since moved from Bridgeport, the home she grew up in still remains, and for her family, the memories are strong and overwhelming. While her father moved to Florida, he still returns to Bridgeport to look for his daughter and uses his Facebook page as a method to share her photos and her story. For her mother, Carmelita, it's a never-ending nightmare from which she can't escape. When asked about the cold nature of her case, the lack of developments, Carmelita was determined that her daughter is still out there somewhere, but that certainly hasn't made the past 19 years any easier. Carmelita explained to the Connecticut Post, quote, "People tell me the memories will fade with time, but it hasn't. Each day only makes the memory and the pain stronger. But we haven't given up. I won't give up." Taking care of yourself is extremely important, and it doesn't have to be difficult either. With CBD, you can feel better without needing to rearrange your whole life. CBD helps me feel more rested, calm, and my body feels a lot less sore, which is a grateful break of pace at this time in my life. Now, I'm not talking about that gross-tasting juice that you drink out of a weird dropper that's impossible to get an accurate dose from. I'm talking about Caliper, a better way to consume CBD. Unlike CBD oils, Caliper CBD powder is tasteless and blends easily into any food or drink without a nasty aftertaste. That's exactly 20 milligrams in each package, taking all the guesswork away. I add Caliper to my morning coffee, and it's a great way for me to start my day. With Caliper CBD powder, you're clinically proven to absorb 450% more CBD compared to tinctures. That's pretty crazy. And Caliper gives you all the benefits of CBD in just 15 minutes, about twice as fast as CBD oil. Caliper comes in both 10 and 30 count packs, and best of all, you can get started for less than $20. Caliper has a special offer for all Trace Evidence listeners. Get 20% off your first order when you use the promo code TRACE at trycaliper.com/trace. You can try Caliper CBD risk-free for 30 days. If you don't love it, they'll give you a full refund, but you're gonna love it. That's trycaliper.com/trace. Don't forget to use promo code TRACE for 20% off your first order today. A 10-year-old goes off to school in the morning and never returns. Hours later, her family learns the truth, that she got into a van with an unknown man who she told others was her uncle. For nearly 20 years, police and her family have sought to uncover the identity of the driver, the nature of his relationship to Bianca, and just how he managed to prey upon the child. While some answers have been found over the years, the most important questions continue to remain unanswered. There were plenty of directions to point the blame. The school, for failing to verify exactly what was going on that day. The family, for being unaware of Bianca's connection to her abductor and her plans for that day. In reality, though, the blame lies on the shoulders of one person, a person who has never been held responsible for the abduction of Bianca LeBron. When it comes to this case, there aren't a ton of theories. There's a large section of people who firmly believe the police had their man, Jason Lara, and simply lack the evidence to file official charges. For others, There remains the possibility that this abduction could have been conducted by an unknown individual, someone Bianca may have met at some point who slowly groomed her. Still, others believe that the truth may be closer to home, and that someone in Bianca's own family was either involved or perhaps possesses far more information about the 10-year-old's abduction than they have ever shared. When you're dealing with a case like this, for the most part, that lacks development and only has limited evidence, there's a lot of room for speculation. Looking up Bianca's name in a quick Google search, you'll surely find plenty of that. I've found a lot of places where people point the finger at the family. While police have never suggested the possibility of a family member being involved, I think a lot of this comes out of Bianca's apparent connection to Jason Lara. The details are a bit fuzzy, and it's frustrating because there are quotes from family members, there are quotes from police, where they specifically refer to Lara as Bianca's secret boyfriend. I think for a lot of people, myself included, it's very difficult to accept that anyone was okay with a 10-year-old girl spending time alone with a 20-year-old man. Now, Lara's fiancé claims he was never alone with her, but then we have others who claim the two had been caught kissing, which just makes me sick to my stomach. I think given the nature of these details coming out, it isn't all that difficult to look sideways at the family. At a minimum, something weird was going on here and no one seemed to think it was out of the ordinary, but I don't know how much of that information the family truly knew, at least in terms of Bianca's parents. When we read that they had been seen kissing, we don't know who saw that, we don't know the circumstances, and while absolutely nothing on this earth is going to justify that behavior to me, I do think it's important to note that we don't know if we're talking about a lip-on-lip kiss or something like a kiss on the forehead. I've seen a lot of debate, but I couldn't find a single source to clarify. Because of that, I tend to imagine it's the kind of kissing no one here would find acceptable. So why wasn't anything done about that? A lot of people also find it disturbing that Bianca's mother filed a wrongful death suit so quickly and fought to have her daughter declared legally dead within months of her disappearance. Honestly, it certainly seems like that happened pretty damn fast, but I don't know what information Carmelita was receiving from investigators at the time. Even they said it was out of the ordinary, though they didn't think there was anything suspicious about it. I think people see the lawsuit and imagine that they're looking at someone who is trying to make money off a tragedy. That's a possibility I can't rule out, but I think it could be a matter of blame. You want someone to blame in a situation like this. When something horrible happens, when a child is taken, you want someone to pay the price, and for Bianca's family, the only real place they could look was the school. The school certainly played a role in this. I was in fifth grade 7 years before Bianca was, and there's no way in hell my teacher was going to let me walk off school property at the beginning of the day without some form of proof of where the hell I was going. A call to my parents, a note signed by one of them, something which would suggest that I'm not just a kid making up a story. The school's failure to follow up, to verify, to even approach the man picking up Bianca is a major factor as to why this crime was able to happen. Regardless of how you feel about the lawsuit, the school made a huge mistake, and that mistake resulted in a 10-year-old disappearing. The thing about the family, though, which sticks with me, isn't the accusations and the speculation, but what they did in the aftermath. They fought to get Bianca's story out everywhere they could, and eventually her story was told through several different television shows, including America's Most Wanted and Maury. Of course, for the latter, there was a lot of discussion with a so-called psychic, and to me it felt rather exploitative, but sometimes that's the price you have to pay to keep a story in the limelight. There never seemed to be a time during those early years that Carmelita rested. Either she was putting up flyers or holding candlelight vigils, she was out there trying to keep Bianca's name in the headlines, and for several years she was successful. Sadly, following the arrest and the subsequent release of Jason Lara, those headlines became fewer and further between. Ultimately, there's never been any kind of shade or suspicion thrown at the family by anyone connected to this case in an official manner. Neither the Bridgeport police nor the FBI, who became involved later, have ever made any connections there. One would imagine they were analyzed quite closely. You're always going to look at family members in the beginning of a child abduction case. It just makes the most sense. Here, though, it seems whoever took Bianca didn't have a strong familial connection. None of Bianca's friends recognized the driver, none of her family recognized the van. While she did refer to her abductor as her uncle, we don't know if that was used casually because she was talking about an older male, or if maybe this person told her to say he was her uncle. Since we're on the subject of Jason Lara a little bit here, we might as well take a look at his place in the theories in this case. So, there's a couple of major details that make Lara seem like a great person of interest. Firstly, he knew Bianca, and from all of the disturbing details that have been released, they seem to have had some kind of extremely inappropriate relationship going. While Lara denied there was ever any kind of a relationship between them, several witnesses claim that something out of the ordinary was happening here. Lara himself was the son of a woman who was dating Bianca's great uncle, which would have, in a sense, made him her uncle. I know we don't know if the term uncle was used officially or not, and according to her family, no one was referred to as her uncle, but logically there's a tie there. Now, police have said that Lara had a friend who owned a van similar to the one seen the day Bianca was taken. Whether or not that van was searched or processed for evidence, I don't know. There's never been any mention of that anywhere, so maybe it's just something they couldn't do without a warrant, or maybe it was checked and nothing was found. Despite my attempts to find further information about this particular area of the case, I couldn't find anything. Either way, though, you've now got a man with a bizarre connection to Bianca who knows someone with a van that fits the description of the one the driver was driving who abducted her. When you look a little deeper, several of Bianca's friends reported that she had a crush on someone named Jason, and there were even family members who referred to Jason as Bianca's secret boyfriend. The same friends who told investigators about Bianca's crush also identified photos of Jason Lara as him being the man she was talking about. Within a short window of time following Bianca's disappearance, Lara leaves Connecticut and moves to Florida with his fiance and child. While Lara and his fiance argued that they had been planning to move for a while, this obviously causes some suspicion. Beyond that, when Lara learns that Bridgeport police are looking for him and want to question him about Bianca, he doesn't present himself. He calls them, doesn't reveal his location, and simply denies any involvement. It isn't until he's arrested on an out-of-state warrant that he's officially questioned. Everything I have read seems to suggest that Lara was questioned very intensely. I know he was questioned multiple times by investigators and that he was a little less than cooperative. Police have never shared too many details about those questions, but they did acknowledge that Lara hired a lawyer and denied any involvement from day one. His lawyer actually told investigators that he was going to dig into the case just to prove that his client couldn't have been involved. That doesn't appear to have ever happened, but following confirmation of an alibi, Lara was set free. I've always wanted to know what his alibi was. I certainly hope it was something more concrete and trackable than his fiance or a friend saying that he was with them that day. Either way, police were put in a tight corner where there was little they could do. If someone was supporting that alibi, they could dig deeper, and I imagine they did, but they were never able to find anything to shake that alibi, at least nothing which has ever been shared publicly. I do think it's interesting to note that 10 years after Bianca was taken, Lara was arrested on unrelated charges, and police once again spoke to him about this case, though he refused to talk about it. It doesn't exactly sound to me like he's been completely exonerated. Publicly, maybe, but there's enough here to imagine investigators probably still have an eye on him. For almost everyone who looks at this case, they eventually get to Lara, and for them, the investigation stops there. He seems to fit the mold. He closely resembles the composite sketch. He's identified as being Bianca's secret boyfriend. He knows someone who owns a similar van. There's a lot there, so it isn't all that difficult to imagine this could be your guy. However, there are some who have argued that while Lara seems to fit the bill, the possibility remains that this could have been someone else, someone police have yet to make a connection to. One of the details which tends to jump out is the use of the term uncle. According to everything we know, while Bianca referred to Jason as a crush and others referred to him as a secret boyfriend, there's never been any examples of her referring to him as her uncle. Now, sure, Lara could have told Bianca to tell her teacher that she was going with her uncle to cover up his identity, but would she have told that same story to her friends? It's hard to know. It seems like she would more than likely have told her friend she was going with Jason. And since her friends were able to identify a photo of Jason as her crush, you'd imagine, considering the descriptions given of the abductor, if it was the same man, they likely could have identified him that day too. For many, these discrepancies are enough to open the door to doubt. And when you've got doubt, then you've got to address different possibilities. From everything we know about Bianca, she was very social, enjoyed talking and meeting people. It wouldn't be too difficult to imagine she could have met someone other than Lara, maybe a family friend or a friend of a friend. Over the course of an unknown amount of time, that person could certainly have engaged in grooming processes which have exposed Bianca to some dark and disturbing possibilities. Based on her crush on Jason, the reports of them being seen kissing, while it greatly disturbs me, I can't completely rule out the possibility that an older male with a predatory nature could have approached Bianca and began trying to groom her through flirtation and romantic gestures, or maybe something entirely different. The possibilities there are somewhat limitless, as child predators have a wide array of methods at their disposal. Could someone other than Lara himself, who is yet unknown, have come to know Bianca over the course of time and managed to groom her? I don't think there's any doubt that the answer there is yes, that possibility exists. I suppose the real problem with this aspect of the theory is how someone would manage to develop that control over Bianca without anyone else noticing. We know she was around Lara, we know she talked about him with her friends, but as far as we're aware, she never mentioned anyone else. For some, they throw in the possibility that this could have been a random abduction, but that doesn't make any sense. The van pulled up and Bianca got in. She clearly recognized the person driving. She clearly felt comfortable and safe enough to believe they were actually going to the mall. I mean, she invited her friends to go with her. There's no doubt that whoever took Bianca, she knew him in some way. Was he someone who introduced himself as an uncle? Was he someone who earned her trust enough to have her lie for him? That we may never know. However, there's something else. Whoever committed this abduction didn't seem to have much concern about being caught. If you wanted to abduct her without anyone seeing, why not plan it for a weekend or after school? Why pick her up from school in the beginning of the day? Maybe the abductor knew that school wasn't going to do what they needed to do, or maybe he was confident enough that he wasn't worried about anyone questioning his motives because perhaps he did have a connection to Bianca. Bianca LeBron was abducted nearly 20 years ago. For most investigators working the case, they believe it's most likely she's deceased, but some hold out for the possibility that Bianca could still be out there somewhere. Maybe she's living under a different name, maybe she's still with the person who abducted her, or maybe she was moved into human trafficking, at which point, if she is alive, she could be anywhere in the world. The facts remain, sadly, that without more information, this cold case seems to be growing colder every year. Without new evidence, a confession, or some major break, the disappearance of Bianca LeBron remains open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Bianca LeBron, honestly, there's not a ton out there, but several Connecticut newspapers have done a pretty in-depth series of articles about the case. Her case was also told on America's Most Wanted, as well as the Maury Povich Show. If you have any information about the disappearance of Bianca LeBron, please contact the Bridgeport Police Department at 203-581-5100. Her case number is 01Y-1051. You may also contact the Bridgeport Field Office for the FBI at 203-382-6647. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. I'd like to take a moment now to thank our amazing Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Aurora K, Brittany Bivens, Brian Kemmerling, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, D. Earthy, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Guillerme Pinto, James, Jason Yeager, Jennifer Winkler, Joanne Berkowitz, Kate Much, Megan Cotter, Michael Graves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Pamela Coburn, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Tara Doble, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, and Tracy Woods. You're all amazing and your contributions are greatly appreciated, as are all patrons. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or visit trace-evidence.com for further information. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.